Once the whaling capital of the world was all but a ghost town by the time the last survivors of the Essex disaster began to pass away. Charles Ramsdell was the first of the Nantucketers to die in 1866. Throughout his life, he was known for his reticence concerning the Essex, in part, one islander surmised, because of his role as Owen Coffin's executioner. Old age was not kind to Owen Chase. His memory of his sufferings in an open boat never left him, and late in life he began hiding food in the attic of his house on Orange Street. By 1868, Chase was judged insane. The headaches that had plagued him ever since the ordeal had become unbearable. Clutching an attendant's hand, he would sob, "Oh, my head, my head." Death brought an end to Chase's suffering in 1869. George Pollard followed his former first mate the next year. The obituary was careful to note that Pollard had been known on the island as something more than the captain of the Essex. For more than 40 years, he has resided permanently among us, and leaves a record of a good and worthy man as his legacy. In the 1870s, Thomas Nickerson returned to Nantucket and moved into a house on North Water Street, not far from where his parents were buried in the old North Burial Ground. Instead of whales, Nantucketers were now after summer visitors, and Nickerson developed a reputation as one of the island's foremost boarding house keepers. One of his guests was the writer Leon Lewis, who, after hearing Nickerson tell about the Essex, proposed that they collaborate on a book about the disaster. Nickerson had talked with Charles Ramsdell about his experiences in the whaleboat with Pollard. He had also spoken with Seth Weeks on Cape Cod about his time on Henderson Island. As a consequence, Nickerson's narrative provides information that was unavailable to Chase. He also includes important details about the voyage prior to the whale attack. But Nickerson, like Chase before him, was not above adjusting his account to suit his own purposes. Not wanting to be remembered as a cannibal, he claims that the men in Chase's boat did not eat the body of Isaac Cole. Instead, he insists it was the extra bread made available to them by the deaths of Cole and Peterson that enabled us to exist until relieved. He also chose not to recount how, toward the end of the ordeal, he suddenly decided it was his turn to die. In April 1879, Nickerson's last surviving crew member in the first mate's boat, Benjamin Lawrence, died. All his life, Lawrence had kept the piece of twine he'd made while in the whaleboat. At some point, it was passed on to Alexander Starbuck, the Nantucketer who had taken over Obed Macy's role as the island's historian. In 1914, Starbuck would donate the piece of twine, wound 4 times into a tiny coil and mounted in a frame, to the Nantucket Historical Association. Written within the circle of twine was the inscription, "They were in the boat 93 days." 18 years earlier, in 1896, the Nantucket Historical Association had received another donation associated with the Essex. Sometime after the ship sank in November 1820, a small chest, 10 by 20 inches, was found floating in the vicinity of the wreck. Leather-bound and studded with brass nails, it may have been used by Captain Pollard to store the ship's papers. It was picked up by the crew of a passing ship and sold to John Tabor, a whaleman then on his way home to Providence, Rhode Island. In 1896, Tabor's daughter, who had since moved to Garrettsville, Ohio, decided that the chest rightfully belonged on Nantucket, and donated the artifact to the Historical Association. It was all that remained of the whale ship Essex, a battered box and a ragged piece of string. Epilogue. Bones. Early on the morning of December 30th, 1997, Edie Ray, coordinator of the Nantucket Marine Mammal Stranding Team, received a telephone call. A whale had washed up on the eastern extreme of the island at Siasconset, just off a low plain of sand known as Codfish Park. A spout was puffing from the top of the whale's head. It was still alive. Soon, Ray was in her car and headed down Milestone Road, a straight, 7-mile spine of asphalt that connects Nantucket Town to the eastern brim of the island. It was bitterly cold and blowing a gale, and the car was slammed by the icy blasts of wind. Ray knew the surf would be ugly at Codfish Park. In the last decade, winter storms had eroded nearly 50 yards from this end of the island. Waves with a fetch that reached all the way to Portugal, 3,000 miles to the east, regularly thundered onto the beach. And in just 6 years, 16 houses had either been moved, torn down, or washed away by the sea. This time, however, the waves had brought something with them. Ray soon saw the whale, a huge black hulk, off the northern edge of Codfish Park. It was a sperm whale, a cetacean almost never seen in these waters, stranded on a shoal about 150 yards off the beach. Its block-shaped head was pointed toward shore, and it was being pummeled by the waves, its tail flopping forward with each hit. The high surf was making it difficult for the whale to breathe. It would be later determined that long before the whale washed up on Nantucket, it had broken several ribs in a collision, either with a ship or another whale. Sick, weak, and disoriented, this 46-foot adult male, half the length of the whale that sank the Essex, did not have the strength to fight free of the breakers. For Ray, it was a distressing sight. She had been trained to assist stranded mammals, including pilot whales and seals, and she and her fellow team members were now powerless to help this giant creature. Word began to spread throughout the island that a live sperm whale had washed up on Codfish Park. By the afternoon, a crowd had assembled, despite the frigid winter weather. Many onlookers were upset that nothing was being done to assist the whale. Lacerations were now visible around its mouth and eyes, and blood clouded the water. Ray and others explained that the severe surf and the whale's size made it impossible to do anything but watch. By the afternoon, staff members from the New England Aquarium, which monitors whale strandings along the region's 2,500 miles of coast, had flown in from Boston. As the tide rose, the whale was able to free itself from the shoal, only to be washed back by the waves. Each time it swam free, the rip swept the whale south, and the crowd, often cheering it on, followed it along the beach. Just before sunset, the whale finally escaped the breakers and swam out into open water. Ray and several New England Aquarium people rushed to her car and drove out to Tom Never's Head, a bluff to the south, toward which the whale was last seen swimming. They glimpsed it several times, but finally lost sight of it in the fading light. The next morning, December 31st, the whale was found washed up on Low Beach between Codfish Park and Tom Never's Head. The wind had eased to the point that stranding team members and aquarium staffers could now approach the whale, which was still alive, but just barely. By noon, it was dead. The Nantucket Whaling Museum, housed in a former sperm candle factory, already had one of the world's greatest collections of whaling equipment, scrimshaw, and artifacts from the South Seas. It even had the skeleton of a finback whale that had washed up in the 1960s. To add the skeleton of a sperm whale, the species upon which the island's fame had been founded, would provide the museum with the ultimate draw. More important, a sperm whale skeleton would allow Nantucketers to appreciate firsthand the might and grace of the whale, to pay homage to the creature their forefathers had once dedicated their lives to killing. On January 2nd, a team of scientists, many from the New England Aquarium, began a necropsy, measuring and photographing the carcass and collecting blood and tissue samples that would later help them determine what the whale had been suffering from. It soon became clear that the whale was decomposing much more quickly than expected, an indication of just how sick it had been before it died. Using scalpels, forceps, and large knives, the team took samples from the lungs, the three stomachs, the bowling ball-sized heart, the liver, the spleen, and the ears, about the size of a man's fist and situated far back in the head. As one group worked at the whale's midsection, a New England Aquarium staff member climbed up on top of the whale. With a long-handled Japanese flensing tool, he made an experimental 6-foot slice into the intestinal cavity, unleashing a gaseous explosion of gore that blew him off the whale and drenched the others in blood. For the next few minutes, rope-like intestines continued to bubble out of the incision. Even though the whale had been dead for several days and the outdoor temperature was well below freezing, the blubber-encased body steamed in the cold January air. The necropsy was finished by 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Now there was the job of removing more than 40 tons of putrefying blubber, meat, and guts from the skeleton. By this point, Jeremy Slavitz and Rich Morcom, two staff members from the Nantucket Historical Association, which owns and maintains the island's whaling museum, had become deeply involved in the whale stranding. Morecambe asked his boss if he could borrow some tools from the whaling museum's collection. After some quick research, he decided that a boarding knife, a cutting spade, and a bone spade were what he needed. Soon the artifacts, their blades long tarnished with age, were once again sharp and glittering. Even though the Nantucketers were now ideally equipped, it was backbreaking work, giving all of them an appreciation for the amount of sheer labor whaling in the 19th century had required. The blubber was not only difficult to cut, even with the sharpest tools, but also remarkably heavy. A single 4-foot square slab of 8-inch thick blubber weighed as much as 400 pounds. The smell was, both Morecambe and Slavitz agreed, beyond description. Their eyes watered constantly. They gagged as they worked. Each night, both of them left their clothes outside their front doors and ultimately, when the cutting was finished, threw them away. Even after long showers, they could still smell the rotting flesh. One evening, Morecambe's wife, knowing that he had spent a vacation day working from dawn till dusk, cooked him up a big steak. But the smell of frying meat nauseated him. A whale wasn't a fish, he now knew all too well, but a mammal. On January 3rd, they punctured the whale's bulbous head, and the spermaceti flowed out. At first, it was as clear as vodka, Morecambe remembered. Then, upon exposure to the air, the fluid magically congealed into a cloudy, almost wax-like substance. In a few short hours, every available bucket and barrel had been filled with spermaceti, and there were still hundreds of gallons remaining. An island fisherman happened to have his dinghy in the back of his pickup truck and offered it as a spermaceti receptacle. Soon it was filled to the gunwale with oil. They ultimately collected about 100 gallons of spermaceti and were forced to leave an estimated 300 more on the beach. By the end of the day, they had cut away most of the flesh and blubber from the skeleton, dumping the offal in a hole dug in the beach and temporarily storing the bones under a tarp. A job that had taken as many as 3 weeks at other whale strandings had been accomplished in only 3 days. The bones were eventually buried in a pit, the location of which was kept undisclosed. The jaw and its valuable teeth were buried in Morecambe's backyard, but only after his wife and children were sworn to secrecy. With advice from a variety of experts in the field, the Nantucketers decided to build cages for the bones and place them in the harbor the following spring, in expectation that marine scavengers would strip the bones of remaining flesh. The day after Mother's Day, Morecambe, Slavitz, and others disinterred the bones, which smelled as bad as, if not worse than, they had when they'd been buried in January. The team loaded them into cages, and the cages were lowered into the harbor near Brant Point, comparatively still waters where all manner of devourers, from crabs to fish, could dine undisturbed. Except for a few barnacles, the bones were clean when they emerged from the harbor 6 months later. Today, the bones reside in a shed designed for the storage of Nantucket Historical Association artifacts. In the center of a room lined with curios, such as an antique sleigh and the first sewing machine to come to Nantucket, are the grayish-white pieces of the sperm whale skeleton, the wishbone of the jaw, the discs of the backbone, the bulky ribs, and the finger-like bones from the fins. The bone that is by far the largest, the cranium, over a ton in weight, sits outside on its own boat trailer. The bones are sopping with oil. A sperm whale skeleton installed at Harvard University a century ago still oozes grease. Morecambe, whose job description as properties manager has grown to include whales, is bathing the Nantucket bones in ammonium hydroxide and hydrogen peroxide, a mixture that extracts oil. The Nantucket Historical Association has already completed plans to build a new museum with the sperm whale skeleton as its centerpiece. The island has changed greatly in recent decades. What was, a generation or so ago, a decrepit fishing village with a famous past and a few tourists in July and August, has become a thriving summer resort. After a century of neglect, downtown Nantucket has been restored. Instead of sail lofts, grocers, and barbershops, however, the buildings now house art galleries, designer clothing boutiques, and t-shirt shops, all of which would have appalled the good gray Quakers of the whaling era. Spurning the cobblestoned elegance of Main Street, Nantucket's latest crop of millionaires build their trophy houses by the beach. People still gaze from the tower of the Congregational Church, but instead of scanning the horizon for oil-laden whale ships, the tourists, who have paid $2 to sweat their way up the 94 steps to the belfry, watch high-speed ferries bringing cargoes of day-trippers from Cape Cod. At the height of its influence, more than 150 years ago, Nantucket had led the new nation toward its destiny as a world power. "Let America add Mexico to Texas and pile Cuba upon Canada," Melville wrote in Moby Dick. "Let the English overswarm all India and lay out their blazing banner from the sun. 2/3 of this terraqueous globe are the Nantucketers." But if the island's inhabitants once ventured to the far corners of the world, today it seems as if the world has made its way to Nantucket. It is not whaling, of course, that brings the tourists to the island, but the romantic glorification of whaling. The same kind of myths that historically important places all across America have learned to shine and polish to their economic advantage. Yet, despite the circus, some have called it a theme park, that is modern Nantucket, the story of the Essex is too troubling, too complex to fit comfortably into a Chamber of Commerce brochure. Unlike, say, Sir Ernest Shackleton and his men, who put themselves in harm's way, then had the luck to live out an Edwardian fantasy of male camaraderie and heroism, Captain Pollard and his crew were simply attempting to make a living when disaster struck in the form of an 85-foot whale. After that, they did the best they could. Mistakes were inevitably made. While Captain Pollard's instincts were sound, he did not have the strength of character to impose his will on his two younger officers. Instead of sailing to Tahiti in safety, they set out on an impossible voyage, wandering the watery desert of the Pacific until most of them were dead. Like the Donner Party, the men of the Essex could have avoided disaster, but this does not diminish the extent of the men's sufferings or their bravery and extraordinary discipline. Some have praised the officers of the Essex for their navigational skills, but it was their seamanship, their ability to keep their little boats upright and sailing for 3 months in the open ocean, that is even more astonishing. Captain Bligh and his men sailed almost as far, but they had the coast of Australia and a string of islands to follow, along with favorable winds. Bligh's voyage lasted 48 days. The Essex boats were out for almost twice as long. From the beginning, the Nantucketers and the crew took measures to provide one another with the greatest possible support without blatantly compromising the safety of the others. Although rations appear to have been distributed equally, it was almost as if the Nantucketers existed in a protective bubble as off-island crew members, first black, then white, fell by the wayside until the Nantucketers had, in the case of Pollard's crew, no choice but to eat their own. The Essex disaster is not a tale of adventure. It is a tragedy that happens to be one of the greatest true stories ever told. Evidence of the disaster and of the men who survived it can still be found on the streets of Nantucket. Captain Pollard's red shingled house on Center Street has long since become a gift shop. On the corner of the building, a small plaque reads, "Built by Captain William Brock in 1760. Later owned by Captain George Pollard, Jr. of the whaling ship Essex." Herman Melville spoke to Captain Pollard, whose story was the basis for Moby Dick. In an age when most of the island's historic houses have been renovated several times over, Owen Chase's home remains one of the last unchanged houses on Orange Street, its dark green trim and water-stained clapboards evoking the somber disquiet of the captain's final years. The boarding house, where Thomas Nickerson once entertained his guests with tales of the Essex, still stands on North Water Street, one of many buildings now associated with a large hotel. The Whaling Museum devotes a small exhibit to the story of the ship that was sunk by a whale. There is a crew list from the Essex's next-to-last voyage that includes the signatures of George Pollard, Owen Chase, Obed Hendricks, Benjamin Lawrence, and Thomas Chappell. There is Obed Macy's Wharf Book, in which the merchant and historian recorded the financial details involved in selling the Essex's oil in 1819. For some reason, the ship's trunk, found bobbing in the Pacific after the sinking, is not on view. The one personal memento of the tragedy, probably used because it takes up so little display space in the crowded museum, is Benjamin Lawrence's tiny piece of twine. But it is the newly acquired skeleton of the sperm whale, oozing oil in the Nantucket Historical Association shed, that speaks most powerfully to the tragedy of the whale ship Essex. The nourishing, life-saving bones of their dead comrades were what Pollard and Ramsdell clung to so fiercely, even after their ordeal had ended. And it is bones that Nantucketers cling to now, tangible reminders of a time when the island was devoted to the business of transforming whales into money. In Moby Dick, Ishmael tells of seeing the skeletons of a sperm whale assembled in a grove of palm trees on a South Pacific island. How vain and foolish, he says, for timid, untraveled man to try to comprehend aright this wondrous whale by merely poring over his dead, attenuated skeleton. Only in the heart of quickest perils, only when within the eddyings of his angry flukes, only on the profound, unbounded sea can the fully invested whale be truly and livingly found out. But as the survivors of the Essex came to know, once the end has been reached and all hope, passion, and force of will have been expended, the bones may be all that are left. Notes. For anyone wanting to know more about the Essex disaster, there is no better resource than Thomas Farrell Heffernan's Stove by a Whale, Owen Chase and the Essex. In addition to the complete text of Chase's narrative, Heffernan's book includes, with the notable exception of the Nickerson narrative, all the relevant accounts left by other survivors. Heffernan's chapters of analysis, including discussions of what happened to the survivors and how the story of the Essex was disseminated, are models of scholarly rigor and readability. Edward Stackpole's pamphlet, The Loss of the Essex, Sunk by a Whale in Mid-Ocean, provides a useful summary of the ordeal, as does his chapter about the disaster in The Sea Hunters, an important book for anyone wanting to know more about Nantucket and whaling. Stackpole's introduction to Thomas Nickerson's The Loss of the Ship Essex, Sunk by a Whale, published by the Nantucket Historical Association, NHA, is also essential. A new edition of Nickerson's narrative is now available from Penguin. Henry Carlyle's novel, The Jonah Man, contains a fascinating treatment of the Essex disaster. If Carlyle takes a novelist's license with some of the facts, Pollard, for example, is depicted as the son of a farmer when it was Chase whose father was a yeoman, his account provides a convincing portrayal of both the ordeal and the community of Nantucket. The NHA's collections contain a myriad of documents relating to the Essex. In addition to Obed Macy's Wharf Book, in which he recorded how much the oil was sold for after the ship's return in April 1819 and how the money was divided among the owners and crew, there are documents detailing the leftover provisions that were sold at auction that month, along with costs associated with repairs performed in South America. From documents in the NHA's Edward Stackpole collection, it is possible to recreate, in part, the makeup of the crews aboard the Essex prior to her last voyage. I would also like to direct the reader's attention to the works of two underappreciated whaleman-turned-authors. Because he was often critical of the Quaker whalemen of Nantucket, William Comstock has been virtually ignored by island historians. Yet his A Voyage to the Pacific, descriptive of the customs, usages, and sufferings on board of Nantucket whale ships, and Life of Samuel Comstock, William's brother and infamous leader of the Bloody Globe Mutiny, contains some of the best existing accounts of whaling in the early 19th century. William Hussey Macy was one of the most insightful and articulate whalemen Nantucket ever produced. Unfortunately, Macy's book, There She Blows, has been forgotten, even though several subsequent and widely read authors relied upon it for information. Originally promoted as a book for children, Macy's work is much more than that, providing a detailed and vivid account of a boy's introduction to both the town of Nantucket and life aboard a whaler. Preface, February 23, 1821. My account of the rescue of the second Essex whaleboat is based largely on the description provided in Charles Murphy's 220-stanza poem, published in 1877, a copy of which is at the NHA. Murphy was the third mate of the Dauphin and tells how the boat was sighted to leeward before the Dauphin bore down to determine its identity. Commodore Charles Goodwin Ridgely's journal records that the two Essex survivors were in a most wretched state. They were unable to move when found sucking the bones of their dead messmates, which they were loath to part with. Cited in Heffernan, page 99. For an account of the discovery of Thomas Nickerson's manuscript, see Edward Stackpole's foreword in the edition of the narrative published by the NHA in 1984, page 7, and Bruce Chadwick's The Sinking of the Essex in Sail. A brief biography of Leon Lewis is in volume 2 of Albert Johansson's The House of Beadle and Adams, pages 183 to 186. Charles Philbrick's poem about the Essex, A Travail Past, is in Nobody Laughs, Nobody Cries, pages 111 to 127. Chapter 1, Nantucket. Thomas Nickerson's remarks are from his original holograph manuscript entitled The Loss of the Ship Essex, Sunk by a Whale, NHA Collection 106, Folder 1. In some instances, the spelling and punctuation have been adjusted to make Nickerson's prose more accessible to a modern-day audience. According to Walter Folger, Jr., a part owner of the Essex, there were a total of 77 ships and vessels employed in the whale fishery in 1819 from Nantucket, in both the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, with 75 ships in the Pacific Ocean alone in 1820, NHA Collection 118, Folder 71. In A Journal of the Most Remarkable Events Commenced and Kept by Obed Macy, NHA Collection 96, Journal 3, November 13, 1814 through April 27, 1822, Macy, who acted as the town's census taker in August 1820, records that 7,266 people lived on the island. Josiah Quincy compares Nantucket to Salem in 1801, Crosby, page 114. Joseph Sansom details the appearance of the Nantucket waterfront in 1811, Crosby, page 140. Another good description of the wharves is found in William H. Macy's There She Blows, pages 12 through 15, 19 through 21. William Comstock's Voyage to the Pacific, pages 6 through 7, describes a voyage during the same time frame as the Essex. The account of the young Nantucket boys on the waterfront is from Macy, page 20. The Essex's specifications are spelled out in her original 1799 register, describing her as having two decks and three masts, and that her length is 87 feet 7 inches, her breadth 25 feet, her depth 12 feet 6 inches, and that she measures 238 tons, and 72 95ths that she is a square-stern ship, has no gallery, and no figurehead. In Heffernan, page 10. In a roster of Nantucket vessels that sailed in 1815, the Essex is listed as having left the island on July 13th, with Daniel Russell as master, George Pollard Jr. as second mate, and Owen Chase as part of the crew. She returned on November 27th, 1816, and sailed again on June 8th, 1817, NHA Collection 335, Folder 976. Her complete crew list for the 1817 voyage is in NHA Collection 15, Folder 57. In his invaluable Nantucket scrap basket, which is greatly indebted to William H. Macy's earlier There She Blows, William F. Macy provides this definition of a walk: a raised platform on the roof of many old Nantucket houses, from which to look off to the sea. Never called Widow's Walk, Captain's Walk, or Whale Walk, as often written nowadays, in 1916, but always just the walk. Writers and others, please note. Obed Macy mentions the comet in his journal on July 7th and 14th, 1819. The New Bedford Mercury speaks of the comet in its July 9th and July 23rd editions. A part owner of the Essex is mentioned in connection with the comet in a letter, dated July 16th, from a contributor in Plymouth. Mr. Walter Folger of Nantucket has been here this week in attendance on the court as a witness and has here continued his observations on the comet, which has been commenced at home. He brought with him a sextant and a small telescope. The sea serpent is mentioned in the June 18th and August 6th editions of the Mercury. I talk about the development of Indian debt servitude on Nantucket in Abram's Eyes, pages 157 through 160. See also Daniel Vickers, The First Whaleman of Nantucket, William and Mary Quarterly. For an account of Burke's speech about the American whale fishery, See my Every Wave is a Fortune, Nantucket Island and the Making of an American Icon in New England Quarterly. William Comstock begins his description of a whaling voyage on a Nantucket whaler with a pointed discussion of the way in which islands foster a unique cultural attitude. Islands are said to be nurseries of genius, an assertion which would be wonderfully supported if we could prove Greece and Rome to have once been two snug little detached parcels of land, situated in the midst of the Mediterranean Sea, and Germany a resurrection of the quiescent Atlanta. I am rather inclined to attribute this opinion to the overweening patriotism of our neighbor, John Bull, whose sea-washed isle produced better things than all the rest of the world can afford, although perhaps America can match him in thunder and lightning. Voyage to the Pacific, page 3. Ralph Waldo Emerson was on Nantucket in 1847. He also records in his journal a strong national feeling. Volume 10, page 63, on the island. In his History, Obed Macy tells of the whaling prophecy and the appearance of Ichabod Paddock, page 45, Hussey's killing of the first sperm whale, page 48, and the exhibition of a dead whale on the Nantucket waterfront in 1810, page 151. J. Hector St. Jean de Crèvecoeur described Nantucket as an oil-fertilized sandbank in Letters from an American Farmer, page 142. For an account of the coming of Quakerism to Nantucket, see my Away Offshore, pages 78 through 87, and also Quaker Nantucket by Robert Leach and Peter Gow, pages 13 through 30. Peleg Folger's poem is quoted in Obed Macy's History, pages 279 through 281. Welcome Green was the Quaker visitor to Nantucket in 1821 who made the disparaging remark about the state of the streets and observed the use of quarterboards as fences. Joseph Sansom wrote about the naming of the town's streets, Crosby, page 142. Walter Folger's comparison of the community to a family is in Crosby, page 97. Obed Macy's remarks concerning the Nantucketers' consanguinity is in his History, page 66. For a more detailed description of downtown Nantucket, see my Away Offshore, pages 7 through 10. See also Edward Stackpole's Rambling Through the Streets and Lanes of Nantucket. According to an article in the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, February 14, 1931, a grand total of 134 sea captains have lived on Orange Street. In 1807, James Freeman remarked that not more than one half of the males and two-thirds of the females who attend the Friends' meetings are members of the society. Crosby, page 132. Charles Murphy, the same man who was on the Dauphin when the Essex boat was discovered, wrote the poem about gazing upon the women during a Quaker meeting. It is in his Journal of a Voyage on the Ship Maria, 1832 to 1836, on microfilm at the NHA. In the same poem, Murphy tells of being with girls over Mill Hills promenading. The Nantucketer William Coffin, father of the man who probably ghost-wrote Owen Chase's narrative of the Essex, spoke of how rarely he strayed from town in 1793, NHA Collection 150, Folder 78. Walter Folger tells of Nantucket children learning Wampanoag whaling phrases as soon as they can talk, Crosby, page 97. The anecdote about the boy harpooning the family cat is in William F. Macy's Scrap Basket, page 23. On Nantucket's Secret Women's Society, see Joseph Hart's Miriam Coffin, where he states, "The daughter of a whale fisherman loses caste and degrades herself in the eyes of her acquaintance if she unites her destiny to a landsman," page 251. Although the poem that begins Death to the Living had been in common use long before, it appears in a sequence of toasts delivered at a banquet in celebration of the voyage of the Loper in 1830, Nantucket Inquirer, September 25th. The statistics concerning widows and fatherless children appear in Edward Byers' Nation of Nantucket, page 257. The gravestone inscriptions for Nickerson's parents are recorded in NHA Collection 115, Box 2. All genealogical information concerning the Nantucket crew members of the Essex comes from the NHA's newly computerized Eliza Barney genealogy. Information about the Nickersons is from the Nickerson family, Nickerson Family Association, 1974. In his Letters from an American Farmer, Crèvecoeur speaks of Nantucket's superior wives and their incessant visiting, page 157, as well as their use of opium, page 160, and the effects of marriage, page 158. Lucretia Mott's comments concerning the socializing of husbands and wives on Nantucket is in Margaret Hope Bacon's Valiant Friend, page 17. Eliza Brock's journal containing the Nantucket Girls song is at the NHA. She kept the journal while on a whaling voyage with her husband from May 1853 to 1856. I discuss the validity of Crèvecoeur's remarks about opium use in the Nantucket sequence in Crèvecoeur's Letters from an American Farmer in the New England Quarterly. For a discussion of He's at Homes, see my Away Offshore, page 257. For an account of the discovery of a He's at Home on Nantucket, see Thomas Congdon's Mrs. Coffin's Consolation in Forbes FYI. Crèvecoeur records, I was much surprised at the disagreeable smell which struck me in many parts of the town. It is caused by the whale oil and is unavoidable. The neatness peculiar to these people can neither remove or prevent it. Page 111. The smell apparently emanated from right whale oil as opposed to sperm oil. See Clifford Ashley's The Yankee Whaler, page 56. Owen Chase, in his narrative of the Essex disaster, claims that the upper works of the Essex were entirely overhauled prior to her leaving in the summer of 1819. William H. Macy describes ships being coppered in Nantucket Harbor, page 14. On the lifespan of a whale ship, see In Pursuit of Leviathan by Davis et al., page 240. Roger Hambridge, shipwright at Mystic Seaport, spoke to me about the phenomenon of iron sickness in whale ships and stated that 20 years was about the average life of a ship, a statement corroborated by the statistical analysis in Davis et al., page 231. Obed Macy's concerns about the condition of whale ships is in a January 1822 entry in his journal. A listing of Nantucket vessels and their owners in 1820 has Gideon Folger and Sons as owning both the Essex and the Aurora, NHA Collection 335, Folder 976. William Comstock makes the derogatory remark concerning Nantucket Quakers in The Life of Samuel Comstock, pages 39 to 40, where he also speaks of the owner's tendency to underprovision their ships, page 73. Davis et al. Have calculated the return on investment shipping agents typically received in New Bedford, In Pursuit of Leviathan, page 411. Nantucket owners in the boom year of 1819 were undoubtedly reaping a similar, if not higher, profit. The description of poor economic times on the mainland is in the New Bedford Mercury, June 4, 1819, which quotes from an article in the Baltimore Federal Republican. The comings and goings of the Nantucket whaling fleet can be traced in Alexander Starbuck's History of Nantucket, pages 428 through 433. William H. Macy speaks of the Grand Plaza of Nantucket, page 15, and how the island's boys would taunt the greenhands, page 21. William F. Macy defines Watching the Pass, page 140. He also defines Foupaw, page 126, Rantum Scoot, page 134, Manavilins, page 131, and the idiom used to describe someone who is cross-eyed, page 121. William Comstock tells of the whittling code on Nantucket, Voyage to the Pacific, page 68. More than 50 years earlier, Crèvecoeur remarked on the Nantucketer's almost compulsive need to whittle. They are never idle, even if they go to the marketplace, which is, if I may be allowed the expression, the coffee house of the town, either to transact business or to converse with their friends. They always have a piece of cedar in their hands, and while they are talking, they will, as it were, instinctively employ themselves in converting it into something useful, either in making bungs or spoils for their oil casks or other useful articles. Page 156. Joseph Sansom tells of how everyone on the island used sea phrases. Crosby, page 143. A sampling of the unique pronunciations of Nantucketers is recorded in Vocabulary of English Words, with the corresponding terms as used by the whalemen, in The Life of Samuel Comstock, page 57. The greenhand, Addison Pratt, tells of how he was examined by the shipowner and the captain, page 12. William H. Macy speaks of how the owners and captains judged the men by their eyes and build, page 19. William Comstock tells of green hands whose ignorance led them to insist on the longest lay possible. Voyage to the Pacific, pages 11 through 12. William H. Macy explains how first-time captains were the lowest in the pecking order in finding a crew, page 19. I have used the time frame described by Nickerson to calculate when the Essex was floated over the Nantucket Bar. Pratt provides a detailed description of the loading of a Nantucket whaleship during this period, page 13. According to Richard Henry Dana, the average allowance in merchant vessels is 6 pounds of bread a week and 3 quarts of water, and 1.5 pounds of beef or 1.25 pounds of pork a day to each man. The Seaman's Friend, page 135. William H. Macy tells of how a whaleship was always full, whether it was with provisions or oil, pages 33 to 34. It is difficult to determine exactly how many whaleboats the Essex was originally equipped with, since Nickerson and Chase seem to disagree on the subject. She had a minimum of 2 spare boats. That it wasn't uncommon for a ship of this period to have 3 spares is indicated by Comstock. 2 spare boats, placed on a frame overhead, shaded the quarterdeck, while another, placed on spars which projected over the stern, was ready to be cleared at a moment's warning. Voyage to the Pacific, page 14. Pratt describes taking a packet from Boston to Nantucket, page 11. According to James and Lois Horton, there were 3 African-American communities in Boston at this time. The black section of Beacon Hill in West Boston, where the Museum of Afro-American History is now located, to the north in the area now occupied by the Massachusetts General Hospital, and near the wharves of the North End. The Hortons say that the North End neighborhood had once been the largest black neighborhood in the city, but was losing ground to the other areas as of 1830. Pages 4 through 5. In Dana's 2 years before the mast, there is a black cook whose wife lives on Robinson's Alley, between Hanover and Unity Streets, in the North End, pages 179 through 180. For a summary discussion of the relative equality enjoyed by blacks on shipboard, see W. Jeffrey Bolster's Black Jacks, pages 1 through 6. James Freeman provides the 1807 description of how blacks had replaced Indians as a workforce in the Nantucket whale fishery. Crosby, page 135. Comstock tells of the harsh treatment of African Americans in The Life of Samuel Comstock, pages 37 through 38. William H. Macy claims that the packet delivering green hands from New York to Nantucket was commonly referred to as the Slaver, pages 9, 17. William F. Macy defines GAM as a social visit and talk. Originally, this term was applied to a school of whales, and its use by the whalemen is doubtless derived from that source. Whale ships meeting at sea often hove to, and the captains would visit back and forth during the time the ships were in company. Under certain conditions, the crews were allowed the privilege also. Page 126. At the onset of his voyage, the green hand narrator of William H. Macy's There She Blows feels that pride in my floating home springing up within me, which every seaman feels for his vessel, page 36. According to Ashley, a sailor's mattress filled with either corn husks or straw was called a donkey's breakfast, page 54. On August 16, 1819, 4 days after the Essex left Nantucket, Obed Macy recorded, "The grasshoppers have destroyed the greater part of the turnips." He also mentions them in September. Information concerning the chili comes from Starbuck, page 432. Chapter 2. Knockdown. The letter written by the Essex owners to Captain Daniel Russell is at the NHA. The marriage of George Pollard and Mary Riddell, June 17, 1819, is recorded in the church records of the South Congregational, now Unitarian, Church on Nantucket, as are the marriages of Owen Chase, the first mate of the Essex, and Peggy Gardner on April 28, 1819, and Matthew Joy, second mate, and Nancy Slade, August 7, 1817. Curiously, the minister was paid $2 for Joy's marriage, $1.50 for Chase's, and $1.25 for Pollard's. For a description of the division of duties among a ship's officers while weighing anchor, see Richard Henry Dana's Seaman's Friend, pages 139 to 140. Information on Captain Pollard's appearance comes from Joseph Warren Finney's Nantucket, far away and long ago, in Historic Nantucket, page 29, with notes by his granddaughter Diana Taylor Brown, to whom I am grateful for providing me with a copy of Finney's original manuscript. Owen Chase's appearance is based on information in the crew list of the Florida, his first ship after the Essex. 5 feet 10 inches tall, dark-complexioned and brown-haired. Heffernan, page 120. In the Nantucket Registry of Deeds Grantee, book 22, page 262, Owen Chase's father, Judah, is listed as a husbandman. Owen Chase's remarks concerning the number of voyages required to become a commander are from his narrative, as are all subsequent quotations attributed to him. While Chase claimed it took just 2 voyages to qualify to be a captain, the evidence suggests that 4 was the usual minimum number of voyages. Stuart Frank, Personal Communication, October 25, 1999. Clifford Ashley in the Yankee Whaler describes the use of a whaler's windlass, pages 49 through 50, as does Falconer in his Marine Dictionary. Reuben Delano in The Wanderings and Adventures of Reuben Delano speaks of the dramatic sea change that occurred among the officers once a Nantucket whaleship left the island, page 14. William Comstock defines Spitfire in The Life of Samuel Comstock, page 71. He also tells of how Nantucketers stuck together aboard a whaleship, page 37. William H. Macy describes the competition among the officers when it came to picking whaleboat crews, page 39. He also speculates that Noah may have been the first captain to address his crew, page 40. Pratt's comments about blacks being relegated to the forecastle of a Nantucket whaleship is in his journals, pages 14 through 15. Richard Henry Dana tells of his preference for the forecastle in 2 years before the mast, page 95. W. Jeffrey Bolster speaks of yarning and other activities in the forecastle in Blackjacks, pages 88 through 89. William H. Macy describes the seasickness cure common among Nantucketers, page 19. My thanks to Don Russell, a descendant of Essex Captain Daniel Russell, who mentioned to me a family tradition concerning this same cure. According to Ashley, the lookouts positioned themselves inside hoops installed on the fore and main royal masts, chest high above the cross trees, page 49. However, at this relatively early period in the fishery, there is no evidence of hoops having been installed on the masts of Nantucket whaleships. In Voyage to the Pacific, Comstock writes, 2 jack cross trees were made by the captain and placed over the topgallant heads, one at the fore and the other at the main. 1 man was stationed on each to look out for whales and relieved every 2 hours. 1 of the boat steerers was kept continually aloft with the man on the main topgallant cross trees, so that while 1 watched, the other covertly slept. Page 20. My discussion of studding sails and the knockdown is based largely on John Harland's invaluable Seamanship in the Age of Sail. According to Harland, the danger of dipping a studding sail boom into the water even applied to a topgallant studding sail. Darcy Lever's 1819 Seamanship Guide provides a detailed and illustrated description of taking in studding sails, pages 82 to 83. He also has a section entitled A Ship on Her Beam Ends, pages 96 through 97. Benjamin Franklin's chart of the Gulf Stream is in Everett Crosby's Nantucket in print, pages 88 to 89. According to Harland, when shortening sail, the most lofty and the most cumbersome sail was got off first, ideally before the squall hit. Studding sails, particularly topgallant and lower, were particularly at risk if the ship were caught unprepared, page 222. The naval saying concerning squalls is in Harland, page 221, as are the other quoted sources. Harland discusses what happens as a heeling ship approaches the point of no return. With greater angles, the riding arm increases rapidly with the angle up to about 45 degrees, after which it decreases and, at a certain critical angle, disappears. Page 43. In his Nautical Dictionary, Falconer provides this definition of beam ends. A ship is said to be on her beam ends when she inclines very much on one side, so that her beams approach to a vertical position. Hence, also, a person lying down is said to be on his beam ends. Addison Pratt tells of a knockdown off Cape Horn. We were knocked down upon our beam ends by a heavy squall of wind. All hands were called to reduce sail, as the decks were nearly perpendicular, the lee scuppers being knee-deep underwater. All the way we could get fore and aft was by holding onto the weather rail. The vessel was pitching heavily and the night being very dark. Page 17. My thanks to Chuck Geig, who shared with me his personal experience of a knockdown on the training ship Albatross in the 1960s, the basis for the movie White Squall. Harland discusses the perils of a ship sailing backward, pages 70 and 222. Chapter 3, First Blood. The American consul at Mayo in the Cape Verde Islands may have known the Essex's second mate. Both Ferdinand Gardner and Matthew Joy were from Nantucket families that had moved to Hudson, New York. The improbable location of a Nantucket-spawned whaling port started in the aftermath of the Revolution. My description of a whale hunt is based on many accounts, but primarily those provided by William H. Macy, Clifford Ashley, Willits Ansell in The Whaleboat, and the remarkable amount of information assembled in The Whaleboat Handbook, used by the Mystic Seaport Whaleboat Demonstration staff. My thanks to Mary Kay Burkaw for making the handbook available to me. The description of how the sighting of a whale enlivened the crew is from Charles Nordoff's Whaling and Fishing, page 100. Ansell speaks of the roles of the different oarsmen, page 26, and the relative speeds of a whaleboat and a sperm whale, pages 16 through 17. Ashley tells of whaleboat crews bent on whaling for glory. They raced and jockeyed for position, and in a close finish with boats jammed together at the flank of a whale, have been known deliberately to foul one another, to dart harpoons across each other's boats, imperiling both the boats and the lives of all concerned, and then to ride blithely off, fast to the whale, waving their hands or thumbing their noses to their unfortunate comrades struggling in the water. Page 110. Comstock recounts the mate's exhortation to his whaleboat crew in Voyage to the Pacific, pages 23 to 24. In Behavior of the Sperm Whale, Caldwell, Caldwell, and Rice record a whaleman's observation that the spout of a whale smelled fetid and stung a man's skin, page 699. Ansell relates Charles Beadle's account of a novice boat steerer fainting at the prospect of harpooning a whale, page 21. According to Clifford Ashley, who shipped out on a whaling voyage in the early 20th century, sperm whales were capable of dragging whaleboats along at bursts of up to 25 miles per hour. He adds, "I have been in motor speedboats at better than 45 miles per hour and found it a tame performance after a Nantucket sleigh ride." Page 80. Francis Olmsted describes the use of a spade to cripple the fleeing sperm whale. Page 22. The lance had a line attached to the end of it, enabling the mate to retrieve it after every throw. Ashley, page 87. Caldwell et al. Speak of dying whales vomiting pieces of squid the size of whaleboats. Page 700. Enoch Cloud's horrified response to the death of a whale occurred during a voyage in the 1850s, and is in Enoch's Voyage, page 53. Ansell speaks of dead whales being towed back to the ship headfirst. Page 23. In his history, Obed Macy provides a step-by-step description of cutting up, including the removal of the head, and boiling a whale, pages 220 to 224. According to Clifford Ashley, early cutting stages were short fore-and-aft planks hung overside, one forward and one aft of the gangway. The Yankee Whaler, page 97. Just how greasy the deck of a whale ship could become is indicated by Charles Nordoff. The oil washes from one side to the other as the ship lazily rolls in the seaway, and the safest mode of locomotion is sliding from place to place on the seat of your pantaloons. Page 129. Nordoff also describes the stench of the tri-work smoke. Davis et al. Speak of ambergris, in Pursuit of Leviathan, pages 29 to 30. According to Obed Macy, the ambergris is generally discovered by probing the intestines with a long pole, page 224. Although whalemen would soon be pioneering the folk art of scrimshaw by carving designs on the teeth of sperm whales, it is highly unlikely that the crew of the Essex in 1819 were saving their whales' teeth. Stuart Frank, Personal Communication, July 1999. J. Ross Brown recounts the murderous appearance of a whale ship at night, page 63. William H. Macy gives the description of appropriate trying out clothes, page 80. Richard Henry Dana tells of how a crew's morale can deteriorate in 2 years before the mast, page 94. For a discussion of the differences in shipboard fare served those in the cabin and the forecastle, see Sandra Oliver's Saltwater Foodways, pages 97 to 99 and 113. Oliver provides the information concerning the average caloric intake of a sailor in the 19th century, page 94. Moses Morrell was the green hand who lamented his gradual starvation aboard a Nantucket whale ship. His journal is at the NHA. If Pollard appears to have overreacted to his men's complaints about food, it was nothing compared to the response of Captain Worth aboard the Globe. When any man complained to Captain Worth that he was suffering with hunger, he would tell him to eat iron hoops, and several times gagged the complainant's mouths with pump bolts. Life of Samuel Comstock, page 73. Chapter 4, The Lees of Fire. Captain Bligh abandoned his attempt to round Cape Horn after 30 days, the time it took the whaleship Essex to double the Horn. That the decision was made under extreme duress is made clear by Sir John Barrow. The ship began to complain and required pumping every hour. The decks became so leaky that the commander was obliged to allot the great cabin to those who had wet berths, page 41. David Porter tells of rounding the Horn in his journal, page 84. Although the Beaver was the first Nantucket whaleship to enter the Pacific, the Amelia, a British ship captained by James Shield, was the first whaler to round the Horn in 1788. Slevin, page 52. Captain Swain's words about the scarcity of whales are cited in Edward Stackpole's The Sea Hunters, page 266. Obed Macy's mention of the need for a new whaling ground was recorded on September 28, 1819. His journal also reveals that he followed the political situation in South America closely. Robert McNally characterizes the whaleman's attitude toward whales as a tub of lard in So Remorseless a Havoc, page 172. Charles Nordoff refers to the old whaleman's delight in trying out, page 131, while William H. Macy speaks of how boiling inspired thoughts of home, page 87. The events that occurred on Nantucket in December 1819 are from Obed Macy's journal. William H. Macy testified to how long it took for mail to reach the Pacific. News from home, even a year old, was hardly welcomed, while the advent of a whaler 5 or 6 months out was a perfect windfall. Page 154. For an account of the discovery of the offshore ground, see Stackpole, pages 266 to 267. Francis Olmsted's description of the delights of Atacamas, pages 161 to 163, includes an interesting account of a chapel. Down the sides of the altar, the drippings of sperm candles used in the service had run like the stalactites of some subterranean cavern, page 171. As far as I know, this is the first time that the name of the deserter, Henry DeWitt, has appeared in print. The name is recorded in a crew list that seems to have been written down soon after Pollard left on his subsequent voyage in the fall of 1821. Pollard is listed as Captain Two Brothers. The list includes all 20 of the previously known Essex crew members, plus Henry DeWitt, runaway. NHA Collection 64, Scrapbook 20. In his discussion of the number of shipkeepers aboard the Beaver in 1791, Clifford Ashley makes the claim that two men would have been insufficient to handle a ship of 240 tons, page 60. William H. Macy records the unique pronunciation of Galapagos, page 167. Colnett's account of his explorations in the Pacific include a diagram of how to cut up a sperm whale that Obed Macy would use in his history. Colnett describes the Galapagos as a sperm whale nursery, a voyage to the South Pacific Ocean, page 147. My summary of Hal Whitehead's observations of sperm whale society are taken from his articles Social Females and Roving Males and The Behavior of Mature Male Sperm Whales on the Galapagos Islands Breeding Grounds. Whitehead did not see whales copulating in the Galapagos grounds. That we never saw copulation is not surprising, he writes. Although there are reports in the literature of sperm whales being observed copulating, these reports are few, somewhat contradictory, and not always convincing. Page 696. Whitehead cites a description made by A.A. Berzin of a male approaching a female from underneath, page 694. The account of repairing a leak on the Aurora is in Stackpole's The Sea Hunters, pages 305 to 306. According to Reginald Hegarty, sea-boring worms could not penetrate metal, but if a small piece of copper was accidentally torn off, quite a section of sheathing would soon be so honeycombed that it would wash off, taking more copper with it. The planking would then be exposed, and in a short time a section of planking would have its strength eaten away, page 60. For an exhaustive description of how leaks were repaired on wooden vessels, see Harland, pages 303 to 304. Herman Melville's description of the Galapagos appears in The Encantadas, page 126. On the tortoise's cool body temperature, see Charles Townsend's The Galapagos Tortoises, page 93. Townsend also speaks of Port Royal Tom, page 86. For a summary of the history of the post office on Charles Island, see Slevin's The Galapagos Islands, pages 108 to 111. Charles Townsend records that the terrapin on Charles Island were exterminated very early, page 89. Chapter 5, The Attack. My description of the scale of the Pacific Ocean is based largely on Ernest Dodge's Islands and Empires, page 7. See also Charles Olson's Call Me Ishmael, especially his concluding chapter, Pacific Man, pages 113 to 119. For an account of the whalers' activities in the western Pacific in the early 19th century, see Stackpole's Sea Hunters, pages 254 to 256. Hezekiah Coffin's death in the vicinity of Timor is referred to in Mary Hayden Russell's Journal of a Whaling Voyage. After mentioning the island of Amboyna, she writes, "Here your dear father, in a former voyage, had the misfortune to bury his mate, Hezekiah Coffin, and where he only escaped the jaws of death himself." NHA Collection 83. For the islands listed in Pollard's copy of Bowditch's Navigator, see Heffernan's Stove by a Whale, pages 243 to 246. Stackpole tells of the first whalers at Hawaii and the Society Islands in The Sea Hunters, pages 275 to 289. William Comstock's description of a mate taking over the harpoon from his boat steerer is in Voyage to the Pacific, pages 24 to 25. Nickerson's narrative claims that Chase was at the steering oar, not, as Chase claims, at the bow with a harpoon in his hand, during their last two attempts to fasten to whales. In this instance, I have decided to trust Chase's account, although the possibility exists that he was, in fact, at the steering oar and that the ghostwriter introduced an error. Adding to the uncertainty is an earlier statement Chase makes in his narrative. "There are common sailors, boat steerers, and harpooners. The last of these is the most honorable and important. It is in this station that all the capacity of the young sailor is elicited. On the dexterous management of the harpoon, the line, and the lance, and in the adventurous positions which he takes alongside of his enemy, depends almost entirely the successful issue of his attack." Page 17. Contrary to what Chase states in this passage, it was the boat steerer who threw the harpoon, and the mate or boat header, never called a harpooner, a term used instead to describe the boat steerer, who was considered the most honorable and important. This may be, once again, a case of the ghost riders confusing the assigned roles in a whaleboat, but for the purposes of this narrative I have taken it to be Chase's description of the role he created for himself on his whaleboat, a mate who threw both the harpoon and the lance and directed the boat steerer from the bow. D.W. Rice, in Sperm Whale, pages 203 to 204, describes a sperm whale's diving habits and mentions the whaler's rule of thumb for judging how long a sperm whale would be underwater. Obed Macy tells of the sinking of the Union in his History, pages 230 to 235. Chase and Nickerson have very different versions of what happened after the first whale attack. Chase claims that the ship began to sink almost immediately. Nickerson makes no mention of the Essex taking on water after the first collision, and is careful to point out that Chase had the opportunity to lance the whale after the first attack, something Chase chose not to mention. I have decided to side with Nickerson, who clearly felt compelled to correct the first mate's account in his own narrative. Both Chase, page 31, and Herman Melville in The Battering Ram chapter of Moby Dick discuss how a sperm whale is well adapted for attacking a ship head-on. An article in the Sydney Gazette, apparently based on information provided by the three Essex survivors who elected to stay on Henderson Island and were later taken to Australia, states, "The vessel was going at the rate of 5 knots, but such was the force when the whale struck the ship, which was under the cathead, that the vessel had sternway at the rate of 3 or 4 knots. The consequence was that the sea rushed into the cabin windows, every man on deck was knocked down, and worse than all, the bows were stove completely in." Heffernan, page 240. A pamphlet written after the disaster by the boat steerer, Thomas Chappell, also refers to the ship being driven backward. Chappell claims the whale knocked off a great part of the false keel when it bumped the ship with its back. Heffernan, page 218. Although neither account mentions the whale's tail still moving after the second impact, in effect pushing the ship backward after the collision had stopped the ship, this appears to be the only way to reconcile Chase's relatively low estimate of the whale's speed at impact, 6 knots, with the other accounts of the ship being driven backward. Hal Whitehead discusses how whalers would seek out bulls in The Behavior of Mature Sperm Whales on the Galapagos Islands Breeding Grounds, page 696. Concerning the size reached by large bull sperm whales, Alexander Starbuck writes in his History of the American Whale Fishery, "Sperm whales which yield 100 barrels are considered very large, but this yield is occasionally exceeded," page 155. He then quotes Davis's Nimrod of the Sea, in which a whale of 90 feet that yielded 137 barrels is mentioned. Davis also claimed that a New Bedford whaler took a sperm whale on the offshore ground that produced 145 barrels of oil. Starbuck asserts that in 1876, the Bark Wave out of New Bedford took a sperm whale that yielded 162 barrels and 5 gallons of oil, page 155. Clearly, an 85-foot bull sperm whale is within the realm of possibility. For a detailed discussion of the brain size and intelligence of